Next case on our calendar for oral argument is Cornerstone Management Services versus Bahia LLC. Good morning. While you are getting settled, I'll remind you each of our procedures in the Court of Appeals. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. It is important that you state your name and identify the parties that you represent when you begin your argument, because we are making an audio recording, which is the only permissive recording of today's hearing. I will also remind you that the podium may be raised or lowered to meet your comfort, and there is a button underneath the front of that will allow you to do just that. So I
Nice.
yes, it's an improvement
Yes.
from the past, that's for sure. All right, then, counsel for appellant, when you are ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Nahida Bul Hassan. I am the attorney for the appellant Bahia LLC, and I'm here today to argue on behalf of my client. Before I start my arguing my issues, Your Honor, I would like to note that there was some misconduct by the court, the district court, in this matter. We have exhibits that were offered, received by the court, and they were removed by the judicial officer from Mendes. For example, Exhibit 136, my exhibit, was offered and received into evidence. If the court looks at the exhibits on Mendes, we'll see that Anthony Keaton is the one who removed all these exhibits.
Have you brought any sort of motion to correct or amend the record in this
I
case?
just realized this last night. And also, Exhibit 151 is listed on the Mendes exhibit list, but has not been provided to the court as well. So there were a lot of misconduct by the court in this matter. With regard to the issues appealed, this matter should not be complicated. There were three written contracts between the appellant and a company known as Oxford Management Properties Services. Oxford is not a part in this case. Mr. Dixon, the owner of Oxford and the owner of Cornerstone, assigned the contract of managing my client's property to Cornerstone.
And that issue of assignment was not litigated in district court. Is that?
Or prevented me from litigating that.
Well, as I read the record, I believe your answer in paragraph 2 acknowledges the assignment of these three management agreements. And I also believe, in looking at the record, that you relied on these agreements in your own request for attorney's fees. Is that accurate?
Well, we relied, we claim attorney's fees based on fraud, and the court did not even let me argue
But
my fraud claims.
you also cited the contractual basis for fees in the management agreements, did you not?
I might be mistaken here, but I'll take what the court said. So here, the three agreements, even if there were written agreements, even if we assume there were written agreements between the parties here to entitle someone to get attorney's fees, Your Honor, there is no basis for attorney's fees in this case. The first issue was clear. The respondent claimed there was an oral agreement to defer management fees. Every record I submitted to the court shows otherwise.
What, help me understand the legal significance of that dispute, given the fact that, as claimed, it was not an agreement to forego payment, it was agreement to defer during the early days of the pandemic. The issue before the district court was what amount was owed, whether it had been owed and deferred receipt. Why does that matter? I'm having a hard
Well,
time
there are two issues.
understanding.
Two issues here, Your Honor. First one, it was the respondent's burden to prove that there was a deferment agreement.
But again, why does that matter if what the respondent asked the district court for was payment of all fees, current fees and those that had been deferred during the pandemic and thereafter. So what difference does that make? Defer is not the same as foregoing entitlement to recover, is it?
Exactly. Because there was no money owed. All the management fees were paid.
Oh, that's, but to me, that's a different issue. And so maybe you and I, maybe I am understanding. It really boils down to whether anything was owed.
Yes.
In the end of 2021.
Yes.
Okay, thank
yes.
you.
Yes. So if we look at Exhibit 158, if there was any agreement in place, Exhibit 158, which is communication between Mr. Dixon and my client's accountant, where Mr. Dixon was explaining or answering many questions. That's Exhibit 158. It just proves that Mr. Dixon was paying down a promissory note. That promissory note was $588,000.
Just to clarify, Exhibit 158, is that one of them that you indicated earlier that is not in the record as of now?
That's 151.
Okay. Exhibit 151 is the only one that's not in the record.
Two of them, 136 and 151. But 158 is Mr. Dixon agreeing that he kept a spreadsheet to keep track with crediting the promissory note or paying down the promissory note. And I tried in court to offer that promissory note to support my claim. There were no deferments, there were no money owed. In fact, Mr. Dixon was paying down this promissory note, which is $588,000. The court refused to accept it from me to support my claim. Also, another issue, Your Honor, here. If we look at Exhibit 113, 114, 115, these are the combined income statements provided by the respondent. The respondent clearly there shows there is an accrual amount, meaning projected expense, and then there is actual expense. When I ask the accountant, Andres Nygren, of the respondent to explain to me, he testified when it shows on the combined income sheet that the amount is actual, that means it's actually paid. So all the document provided by the respondent show that the respondent was paid in full, and in fact,
But doesn't Mr. Nygren also go on in his testimony to talk about that the income statements really aren't germane to the accounting for the accrual of the management and other fees that hadn't been paid? It's a different set of documents.
Well, here the court made a huge mistake. The court considered the amount of $104,810 paid by my client as CAM fees, common area maintenance fees. But the contract is simple. You collect money, you use that money to pay all expenses, and the money is collected from the tenant, has two portions. One is the base rent, the other is the common area fees that goes by square footage, and that amount covers utilities, management fees, supplies, payrolls, mortgage, taxes, all of that is collected from the tenants. To come at the court to come and say the client, my client was only collecting $10,000 to cover all of that, including the $9,710 to pay that to the respondent, is absurd. All this combined statement will show these are the pass-through, they call them pass-through because you get them from the tenant, you get the money from the tenant, and you use that money to pay the expenses of the business. There were so many red flags, Your Honor, and everything showed, I submitted to the court to show that there was no money owed. In fact, Mr. Dixon overpaid itself, the company. I submitted as part of my answer to the complaint that there is no money owed. The money was paid, and one of my attachments to my answer on counterclaim showing by calculation.
Right, and the district court considered all of the evidence presented and made findings about the credibility of witnesses, including that, you know, that the testimony offered by one of your witnesses was not credible because that witness did not understand the accrual accounting method that Cornerstone was using. It feels like you're asking this court to make new findings of fact and to weigh evidence.
I am not even talking about the testimony. I'm talking about evidence
right,
submitted. For example,
testimony is evidence, is it not?
Well, I'm not arguing that here. I'm arguing about the evidence that the court allowed me to submit. For example,
the financial records.
Yes. For example, if we look at Exhibit 160, Exhibit 160 will show that Cornerstone was in charge of my client's money until September 2020, when my client hired Bill.com to pay the expenses. The court said there was no breach of fiduciary duty because Cornerstone did not have a control over my client's money. In fact, Exhibit 160, the original exhibit was 62 pages. Going back to September, going back before Bill.com came in place in September 2020, and it shows Mr. Dixon was writing checks signed by him, $19,000, $23,000, when the monthly management fee was only $9,710.
You said you are sure that Mr. Dixon was writing checks?
Yes. All the checks are okay, signed by Dixon.
How are you sure?
It's written there on the check, Mark Dixon. All the checks were signed by Mark Dixon, and he was in control of my client's money because before we did the audit here, Your Honor, there were three bank accounts. Mr. Dixon was in charge of all the three bank accounts of my client.
That changed at the end of 2019, correct? I mean, that's when your client hired Prudent Accountants, and Prudent Accountants then put the Bill.com in. So I'm having a hard time understanding how fraud and embezzlement comes about at a time when, in fact, it's Prudent Accounting and others who are controlling.
If we look at Exhibit 160, you will see, starting with 2020, and the court removed all the checks that Mr. Dixon wrote to himself in 2019, showing that he was in control. He was overpaying himself or his company. The only time Mr. Dixon was not in control was in September 2020, when Bill.com started paying all the expenses. And if we look why, MP, the accountant, Prudent Accountant, was to get income statement, expenses list from Mr. Dixon, and then they will transfer the money to an account that was established specifically by Shakir, Najib Shakir. So all the money gets to deposited in the distribution account. We call it 3661. And then there is another account, I believe it's 6413. That's the account where Shakir would transfer the money that got deposited after get collected from the tenant in the distribution account. Actually, Mark Dixon was told to deposit the money in the distribution account. And once they request, even Exhibit 158 will show that, once they request, we need this much to pay the expenses, then the amount will get to be sent to the account 6413. But instead of paying my client's bills, Mr. Dixon overpaid his company because he was in charge until Bill.com came in place. And that was my argument. There was a breach of fiduciary duty here. And the court made the finding that there was no control. Yes, there was. Just look at Exhibit 160, Your Honor. You will see Mark Dixon and all the exhibits that the court excluded here. For example, to show the overpayment, that the evidence to support that there was no money owed, I'll ask the court to look at 113, 114, 115, 118, 121, 122, all the way to 160, Your Honor. And if we look at Exhibit 132 by itself, that's the one from 2019.
Well, but that predated, I as I looked at the answer and counterclaim, the allegation that the fraud was between the period of June 1st, 2020 and August 31st of 2021. So, I mean, I think that's why the district court excluded the documents that you are referring, because they predate that period of time.
Even with that period of time, if we look at the one of the exhibit, he fully paid, and I cited that in my brief to the court. There were many, many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars. If we just look at, well, we can't look at it because the court excluded it. Exhibit 132, it shows that Mr. Dixon paid itself 320,870.90 in 1 year, when the annual management fees was 116,520. So he overpaid itself by 204,350.90. That within the period, and the court did not let me introduce that. So, in conclusion, this case was a mess. The court, I think I'm out of time.
We'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Correspondent.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joseph Heinrichs, and I represent Cornerstone Management Services, LLC. This court should affirm the district court's decision to award respondent damages against appellant for unpaid management fees and attorney fees, as well as affirm the district court's dismissal of appellant's claims of fraud by embezzlement and accounting fraud, as the evidence presented through the trial is sufficient to sustain the finding of facts of the district court, which consequently sustains the conclusion of law and judgment.
Do you agree, before we get farther, and there was an argument about the sufficiency of the record, do you agree that in fact the transcript of the trial is part of the record before this court?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, I do. That was a mistake on my end. I missed it, and so I apologize, but I do recognize that.
Thank you.
This case and this appeal comes down to whether there was a valid contractual agreement between the parties and whether there was a breach of contract by either party. The parties agree that there was written contracts that were initially entered into by appellant in Oxford Management Services. That contract was consequently assigned to the respondent on May 1st, 2019. That fact has been conceded by appellant in their own pleadings. They, as the court mentioned, there's mentions in there of the agreement and the amount that was supposed to be owed to respondent during the time frame. And so on appeal, they've argued against the existence or the validity of the assignment. So I will touch on that. The big issue is whether appellant was in agreement with the assignment or provided notice was the arguments really provided. The first issue is whether or not appellant agreed is not relevant. The Minnesota law is clear that an assignment is valid so long as the grantor manifests an intent to assign a specific right, and that is City of Cloquet v. Crandall, 824 Northwest 2nd, 648, 652, Minnesota Court of Appeals, 2012. Minnesota law does not require any specific language to create an assignment. The assigner just must manifest an intent to assign, and he can't retain a right to revoke. The assignments were entered into evidence. There's no right to revoke. It's interesting, I suppose, that the individual that assigned it for Oxford and Cornerstone was the same individual, but as a representative for both, that's valid. The record is clear that that assignment was done in the presence of a representative for appellant.
Was it required by the three agreements that the client, Baheja, give consent to this assignment?
I don't believe the contractual agreements between the initial three contracts entered into required consent. However, it's our position that Appellant did agree to these assignments. This assignment was done on May 1st of 2019, and the business relationship between appellant and respondent continued till at least August of 2021. And so to come back after all that time and say that we were not in agreement with the assignment, I don't think is accurate. And I think the evidence in the form of interactions between the parties shows that there was an agreement on behalf of appellant as well.
In other words, by performance.
Correct, Your Honor. And so if the court agrees that the assignments were valid, the next issue to look at is whether there was a breach of the contract. For a respondent, the standard of proof is preponderance of the evidence. And so we need the formation of a contract, performance of any condition precedent to the right to demand payment, and then a breach of contract. Here, the parties appear to agree that the condition precedent was satisfied by the fact that respondent continued to provide management services to appellant.
What's the legal significance, if any, to the agreement in early or mid-2020 that your client would defer receiving payment in light of, you know, the pandemic and that impact on rental rates and payment?
Of course. Your Honor, I don't think the legal significance in this matter is very significant at all. We're not there was no request for interest charge. There was no request for late fees. If I was here asking the court for a payment above what we contractually agreed to, then whether or not there was an agreement to defer would come into play, because then we probably would not have the right to ask for interest. Here, the parties agree it was an agreement to defer, which just means payment's not due yet. It doesn't change the bottom dollar that becomes due per that agreement right there. In addition, I think it also goes to the business relationship that these parties had over time. If you look at the agreement to defer, and if you look at the contract for Odd Fellows, the management fees that respondent and appellant agrees is owed is less than the amount that's actually written out in that contract, because the parties over time had oral discussions about that cost, agreed to lower it slightly, and then they proceeded. And so the parties have shown that business temperament to agree to proceed without something written. I don't believe the agreement to defer is relevant. I certainly think, you know, it occurred here. I don't think the parties necessarily disagreed up until this point. And so with the breach, it's our position that the management fees were not paid. And the counsel has talked a lot about various documents that were either admitted into evidence or were denied. I do just want to raise, and I think Your Honor mentioned this and spoke about this briefly, the relevant time period is June 1st of 2020 through August 31st of 2021. That is the time period for which appellant pled that there would have been fraud. And so throughout the course of the trial, there were attempts to enter evidence of different documents. I believe that promissory note was from 2015. And so there was a lot of things that were not let in because they were beyond the relevant time frame. As far as the evidence that the court received that was relevant to what money was paid, respondent submitted our premier bank account, which showed all of the money that respondent received from appellant for the relevant time periods.
Why don't the various income statements and other financial reports and documents that appellant did offer and were received into evidence, why don't they cite, or why don't those documents support the fraud claims?
Well, those documents are relying on an accrual-based accounting system as opposed to a cash-based accounting system. And so those statements aren't showing what money was changing hands. It was showing what costs were accruing per month for the management fees, pass-through expenses during that deferment period, as pass-through expenses continued on. Those costs were reflected on those accounting statements, but they weren't the full picture. Frankly, this was a case that was a very difficult to get a full picture of the accounting. As it's been spoken to, appellant moved its billing system to bill.com through prudent accounting. And during that time frame, when...
And that happened in May of 2020.
Correct, Your Honor. It happened in May of 2020 when appellant's representative Shift moved to an individual named Shakir Naheeb. It was fully implemented in September of 2020. What is the big picture here is Mr. Naheeb was present until 2021 when Mr. Al-Latifaha returned. And when he returned, he cut off the relationship with Bill.com and Prudent Accounting, and they lost everything. And so they weren't able to produce any of the documentation that was relevant towards what payments were received, what payments were not received. It came down to our bank statements. This is how much we received, and then going through the record indicating everything that was owed to respondent during this time frame. And so during that relevant time period, respondent received a total of $104,810 from appellant into its Premier bank account. There was no evidence that there was any other monies received or exchanged from appellant to respondent during this time frame. During this time, respondent was entitled to receive $98,400 for pass-through CAM expenses, which is $10,000 per month for June through August of 2020, and then $5,700 per month for September of 2020 through August of 2021, $4,000 in brokerage fees, $5,600 in cleaning fees, and then the $174,780 in management fees. And so this total that they were to receive, apologize, Your Honor. The total they were to receive was $282,780, and instead they received $104,000. And so right there, I think respondent satisfies its claim that there was a breach of contract. The parties don't disagree that respondent was owed management fees during this time period. And the record before the court shows that we received X amount and there was $177,970 outstanding that was not received. And so in addition to confirming the breach, I also think this goes towards appellant's claims of fraud.
Well, aren't those really two separate issues? And with respect to the fraud, I mean, I realize you're focusing on the June 1st through August 31st of 2021 time period, but my understanding of that might make more sense if you're talking about actual versus accrual method of counting. I mean, don't you need to look broader with accrual because it's not, you know, right at that time?
I agree, Your Honor. I do think in the way in which we sorted out the dollars here, because to be very clear, I think when this matter was initially started, it wasn't 100% clear how much had been paid, what was 100% owed. Respondent, as the court order reflected, there was more money out there that we weren't even requesting repayment. And I don't.
And you're not requesting, no.
Correct. And I think that was in part due to perhaps the accrual accounting system and that they didn't have a great picture of what that dollar amount was. And so through trial, all we did was we showed that the payments received from that June date and through the August date of the next of 21, this was all we received. And then point by point each month, what we were supposed to be receiving for management fees, cleaning, brokerage, and pass-through expenses. There was limited evidence that was allowed to be entered prior to that June. The assignments was in May of 2019. And so if appellant would have been making these big payments earlier in 2020, that was somehow getting ahead of what was owed, and so that there was a balance there. One, I think this is inconsistent with, you know, appellant approaching respondent and asking for a deferment on management fees because costs were high and they weren't able to afford it. But also, I do believe that evidence would have been presented if there was any evidence of that. Up until that May date, the documents or the payments that were coming through were through the Premier bank account. We still had access to it. Appellant had that authority to pay the bills as they became due. And so they were paid on time and there wasn't anything outstanding for us to bring up to the court. And so I think that's why we focused on solely starting on that June date and then proceeding through the August date. In regards to the claims of embezzlement, I think what the record is clear is that respondent lost its authority to handle appellant's accounts in order its authority to pay its own bills, to pay its past due CAMs, starting it in September of 2020. In the record, Mr. Al-Latif Aha testified that even when he returned in 2021, he did not return this authority to respondent. That stayed with him, and payments, you know, the relationship then ended. And so in order for the court to find that respondent had this authority, because there was a fiduciary response, or respondent had fiduciary duties, they were placed in a position of trust to manage the commercial properties. And so we concede that. However, in order for the court to find that respondent had the authority to manage the accounts or otherwise, it would have had to have occurred between that June 1 of 2020 and through September 1 of 2020, because after that point, the parties agree respondent lost all authority to handle those accounts. Likewise, in regards to accounting fraud, a person is liable for fraud if he makes a false representation of a fact, past or existing material fact, susceptible of knowledge, not knowing it to be false, or as of to know of his knowledge without it knowing whether it is true or false, with intention to induce the person to whom it is made to act in reliance upon it, or under such circumstances that such person is justified in acting in reliance upon it, and such person is thereby deceived and induced to act in reliance upon it, and to his pecuniary damages. It's the last word in there, but I think it's just as important as the rest. Not only has appellant not presented any evidence of documents that were forged or financial statements that were invalid presented by respondent, but appellant also hasn't showed the damage that occurred through this alleged fraud.
I'm going to cut you off now. You are over your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Abul Hassan, you may proceed with your 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Yes, thank you. The issue is simple, Your Honor. It's not accrual or actual. I provided canceled checks. The respondent refused to give me any document. I sent several subpoenas to several financial institutions, including the respondent's own bank account statements with canceled checks. Refused to give that to me. The document he provided in court, that was the result of my subpoena response. I provided canceled checks. Cornerstone salary per month is $9,710. That's per year is $116,520. The canceled checks the court did not let me introduce shows that Cornerstone was paying itself the $9,710 three times per month. At times, Cornerstone was cutting checks $40,000 per month.
And what counsel, time period are you alleging these payments were made?
When Cornerstone assigned, even if we don't talk about the Oxford time, this is when Cornerstone started managing.
Is this pre-June 1st of 2022?
The pre-June, the court canceled checks did not let me include them because on May 1st, 2019, Cornerstone was in charge of my client's money. But there were massive unpaid bills sent to collection. Where did the money go? Cornerstone gave it to itself.
But counsel, to the extent you're relying on canceled checks or other documents that the district court did not admit and they're not in the record, this court can't consider that, correct?
I understand, but even if you look at 160, you will see Cornerstone was paying itself massive amounts of money because Cornerstone was in charge during that time until Bill.com came in place in September 2020. There is no issue of CAM and massive payments. The contracts themselves do not authorize Cornerstone to make any expenses payment on behalf of my client. The contract that's on page 4 of Exhibit 101, 102, and 103, it says the management company shall not pay any of the expenses of the client. All the expenses must be paid from the money collected. To come in court and say, claim that Cornerstone paid the expenses and the camp of my client, just look at bill.com invoices. I mean, the payment, proving that there were hundreds of thousands of dollars that were not paid by Cornerstone. And that's why bill.com started making this payment until they're finally paid. Why? Because Cornerstone was just taking the money and not paying my client's bills. Why would my client have like $82,000 utility?
Again, the fraud as alleged in your counterclaim began on June 1st, 2020.
Even with that, Your Honor, even with that, I even subpoenaed bill.com. I got all the records. They are admitted into evidence.
And once Bill, just so I'm making sure I understand, once bill.com was in place, Cornerstone no longer had access to any of your client's accounts. Correct.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Bill.com was in charge of paying the bill that Cornerstone failed to pay for years.
Counsel, I want to, you only have a minute left, so I want to go back to the oral deferment agreement. Do you agree that there was an oral deferment agreement?
There was none, because the record I submitted to the court shows there was no hardship. My client business was making money. And even Mark Dixon testified that during COVID, a lot of tenants applied for PPP loans, which is Paycheck Protection, whatever, program. And that's written in 158 as well.
But the district court found Dixon's testimony credible.
Yes.
So it's a credibility determination as to whether or not there was actually an oral deferment agreement.
It's not about that. The record themselves, Mr.
Right, but the record, that part of it was based on the oral discussions between the parties.
No, there was no oral discussion. That was a lie, and we provided evidence to show that there was no hardship. In fact, Ms. Dixon himself was telling the owner, "Oh, we're making money. We're making money," and with all of this, I just want the court to look at Council Exhibit 12 to see that here they're asking for $9,710. That's in August 2021, $5,700 as the payroll of the employees, and $5,600 the cleaning. And Andres admitted that money was paid. There was $35,020 that Dixon denied. Anders admitted they were paid.
All right, counsel, I'm going to stop you now. You're a little over your time as well, so I think you both exceeded a bit, but you each got about the same amount overage.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Yep.
We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.